You're listening to Don't Call Me. I'm Em. This season is called Say It Happened. These are the stories I was never allowed to tell, the ones that got twisted, buried, or used against me. I'm telling them now, in my own time, in my own voice. This series is meant to be heard in order. If you're just joining, please go back to episode one of this season and start from there. Every episode builds on the last. This is a full body story, not fragments. This episode includes themes of domestic abuse, emotional manipulation, estrangement from children and family, and trauma. These are not abstract ideas or things that happened. If you're not in a place to hear that today, come back when you are. I didn't go straight to the women's shelter. Before that, I stayed at David's place. He was kind to let me stay there, but I was not okay. I was barely functioning. I'd lay down exhausted from the weight of it all, the grief, the anxiety, the silence from people I thought were supposed to love me, and just when my body would finally give in and fall asleep, it would launch me upright like something was hunting me in my dreams. I'd wake up gasping for air, heart pounding, soaked in sweat. Sometimes I couldn't remember the dream, just the feeling. Other times I remembered all of it, every detail. They were usually about losing the kids or running from someone or screaming from help and no one hearing me. I never woke up rested. I woke up scared. Every night felt like a betrayal, like my body wanted to rest, but my brain wouldn't let me. I'd sit there in the dark in that unfamiliar room wondering how it got to this. Not in a self-pitying type way, but in a what actually happened kind of way. I knew the events, but the truth had been so twisted I couldn't find the thread anymore. Eventually, I put myself into the shelter. It was raw there. Quiet, but never really quiet. The kind of place where no one asks too many questions because everyone's just trying to make it through the day. But I remember the staff. Some of the counselors were incredible. And the other women, they were surviving just like I was. That kind of pain has a look in the eyes. You start to recognize it. After a few weeks, my birthday came. I didn't tell anyone. I didn't expect anything. Honestly, I just wanted to pretend it wasn't happening. I was in a shelter, cut off from my family, reeling from what had happened with the courts, my ex, with the lies, all of it. But Roz knew. One of the staff. She was this tough, no-nonsense woman who had probably seen more shit in her years working there than most people could imagine. She wasn't the warm and fuzzy type. She was hard-shelled and sharp and a little intimidating. But that day, she handed me a small gift bag. It was just a few self-care items, lotion, snacks, body wash, things like that. Nothing fancy, but it broke me, and not in a bad way. It broke through the part of me that had gone numb. Ross said, "Celebrate every year of survival." And I heard that like a command, not a suggestion. It shifted something in me. Up until then, I hadn't really celebrated my birthday in any real way. Maybe a dinner here or there, but I never honored it. I never paused and said, "I survived another year." And from that moment on, I did. Every year, it became sacred, and it still is. During those final weeks in the shelter, I made a decision. I enrolled in school. A bachelor's degree in sociology. I didn't just want to survive. I wanted to understand. I wanted to know what the hell had happened to me. I chose classes like family counseling and even Shakespeare, not because I was some literary scholar, but because I wanted to understand how people use narrative and how they twisted stories. One quote stuck with me hard from Macbeth. "Life is a tale. Told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing." it became this dark little anthem for me. That's how the system felt. That's how people's stories felt. Everyone was loud. Everyone had an opinion. And none of it meant anything because it wasn't rooted in truth. It was rooted in convenience, in power, in comfort. I didn't have money. I lived off student loans. That's what kept me alive until I graduated. People don't realize how often women rebuild their lives with debt, with borrowed time and borrowed money. But I was determined. My plan was to become a therapist for survivors, for women like me. I didn't just want to get through it. I wanted to understand it. Eventually, I moved into a studio apartment. I was proud of that place. I didn't have much. A microwave, a cheap little kitchen table, and a loft bed I bought because I wanted the kids to have a place to sleep when they came to visit. The gratitude I felt in that apartment was overwhelming. I would stand in that space, look around at my beat-up table and secondhand dishes, and just cry, not because it was sad, but because it was mine, because I had something again. That's when I started making jewelry. At first, it was just a creative outlet, something with my hands, but eventually I got the chance to sell my pieces at a local boutique. That shop became a sanctuary. The owner, Chris, a woman with this cool energy and a real eye for beauty, saved my life. She let me bring in my pieces. She let me talk. She let me just exist. And eventually she became a close friend. I started hanging out there a lot. Not because I needed to sell something, but because I needed something. Purpose, normalcy, light. Chris gave me that. But while I was slowly rebuilding, I was still a mother, and the conversations with my kids were sparse. And every time they were allowed to talk to me, someone started a fight. Him, his mother. Sometimes even the kids. Not because they wanted to, but because they knew someone was listening, and if they said too much, there'd be consequences. Being exposed to me meant punishment for them. So I backed away. Not because I wanted to, but because staying present in their lives under those conditions meant harm for them and for me. They were told I didn't love them. They were told that I had chosen David over them, that I was selfish, that I walked away. They were never told the part where I was holding the pieces of our lives in my bare hands, bleeding, still trying to find a way to rebuild a home for them. I knew what I was doing wasn't for the right now. It was for the future. I carried the responsibility of building a life that could sustain us all. Phone calls with my family were torturous. They didn't want to hear what he was doing to the kids. They didn't want to hold that kind of truth, so they shut it down. They made it about me. About my tone, about my choices. And I realized I really was on my own. I went from the shelter to a studio apartment, then to a one bedroom, and eventually to a three bedroom house. I got a job. I was building. But I was still estranged from my family. That lasted 5 years. 5 years without real check-ins, without holidays, without hearing from them while I was doing the hardest work of my life with no hand to hold. But that was the year I started counting. Not just years of my life, years of me, years of survival, years of becoming someone no one could twist a story about anymore. If this episode stayed with you, if it made something clearer, heavier, or more human, please share it. Not for me, but for whoever's out there thinking they imagine what happened to them. Thanks for listening to Don't Call Me. As always, take care of yourselves and one another.